Because at the end of the day, it's up to the treating practitioner to decide, and they're in the best position to know because they've done the treatment, they know what they've done.
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and although we're now in over 60 countries, this one is for the Aussies. We're getting stuck into the ADA item schedule. And I know this is it's riveting stuff, but bear with me for a moment. When we jump out of dental school into private practice, this is our Bible. It's how we itemize patients. It's how we let them know what we've done and let the health funds know what we've done as well. And it can come with some complexity. There are situations where we're not sure how to itemize people, or there are situations like I'll talk about in this podcast where the health fund might reject something that you think is actually legitimate. This episode, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. David Kernow. He's a private practitioner and a long-standing ADA member and counselor. David has been giving back to the profession by serving with the ADA since just after his graduation, so he has a wealth of knowledge. He was actually the ADA Victoria president for a while, but now he finds himself as the chair of the ADA Item Schedule and Third Party Committee. This episode is a bit dense. It's a deep dive into the item schedule, and I hope people find it useful. If you've ever had a claim rejected or been confused about claiming, this will certainly help you out. I'm stoked to announce we've got support from BOQ Specialist Bank. They're someone that has actually helped me when I graduated through my years into private practice, and I really appreciate them also supporting the Dental Head Start community and podcast and graduates in general through their grants and support. Something I absolutely love is when I see people trying to give back to their community. BOQ Specialist feels the same way. They've developed the Future Focus Grant, which gives successful applicants $2,000 for their travel costs for overseas placement and $500 to spend in the community when they're there. If you're a dental student and you plan to travel outside Australia to do volunteer work, then you're eligible to apply for this grant. The successful applicants will also receive a GoPro so they can film the trip and inspire others to do the same thing. So if you're interested in applying for this grant, check out dentalheadstart.com/BOQ Specialist Grant for more details, eligibility criteria, and terms and conditions. Thank you, BOQ Specialist, for supporting dental students volunteering overseas and for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast. Make sure you get in quick. Applications close 30th of August 2019. So Dr. David Kernow, welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast.
Pleased to be here.
So thank you for joining us, David. And the reason I've brought you on here today is because I really want to get into some of the things around the ADA item schedule and some stuff that I think graduates and young dentists really need to get their head around. Obviously, when we graduate, we haven't had a lot of experience with itemizing and there's always procedures we haven't even done before. So thank you for joining us. And can you tell us a bit about, you know, your position and what you do with the ADA?
Well, I'm chairman of the Schedule and Third Party Committee, and that committee has responsibility for the schedule. Although it's an advisory committee, though, not a decision-making committee. So the committee advises the ADA Federal Council on adjustments to the schedule, changes. The schedule is continually evolving, and as such, as is dentistry, so obviously procedures are come into use, other things change or decline in the usage, and the schedule has to reflect that over time. We also help stakeholders, which might be members, non-member dentists, private health insurers, patients with matters related to schedule activity. So the committee members will either field in writing, will advise staff at the ADA, or at times will directly speak with people about queries around item numbers. The other part of our activity is monitoring and looking at the activities of third party funding agencies, including private health insurers, DVA, etc.
Yeah, and that's a really important thing that I want to get into as well a bit later on. David, tell us, how do you find yourself as the chairman of the ADA schedule, tell us a bit about your history with the ADA and how you ended up there.
Well, I suppose I started out relatively soon after graduating. I was probably volunteered by someone else into being the secretary of our local dental group. Just in the area where I practice. And from there, you speak with your colleagues and then you go to broader state ADA-based meetings, and I became involved in some committees here in Victoria. I became an ADA Vic branch councillor, which I still am. Mm-hmm. And I've been ADA Vic branch president, and then I've become just progressively involved in a range of different activities, I suppose culminating in moving on to becoming involved in this federal committee and being involved in the Congress. So I was chairman of the Melbourne Congress. So I find it a very interesting counterpoint to being a practicing private dentist, so to speak.
Yeah, so you obviously are a practicing private dentist, and you're in Victoria, as you mentioned. So you got yourself into the ADA, organised dentistry pretty early on. Do you think that was a good move?
Oh, well, I've certainly. It's been something that's contributed greatly to my own development, and hopefully I've made a bit of a contribution to dentistry in general. But it's created a broad professional network, made many good friends both here in Victoria and in all around Australia who are involved in these things. And, I'd recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And it's something that I'm sure there's a few listeners who are toying with the idea of getting involved with the ADA and other associations. They'd be interested to hear that.
Yeah, there's lots of opportunities for participation. Our council at the moment has a wide range of members who come from different backgrounds, different age groups, and so it's quite diverse. And, of course, there's not just council membership, but there's lots of committees that might reflect an area of particular interest that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And these different committees, such as the schedule and third party committee, they all have their specific interests. How much time are you putting aside for this kind of thing? I know in the past you were the president of ADA Victoria, probably more time then, I assume.
Oh,
how
yes.
is it now?
Yes. Oh, look, it's I'm involved in a few other things as well, but it can be busy at times. But then life can be busy. I spend a little bit of time at work, a little bit of time at home like this. It's probably become easier for me at this stage in life because I've got, grown-up children and they're off doing their own thing and you don't have those sorts of responsibilities quite so much. So it's not that you do have a bit of time.
Yeah, I'm at the exact opposite end of that. I've got an 11-month-old daughter, so, one day I'll have time.
Fun times are ahead.
That's for sure.
It's great over the next few years, I reckon.
It's been great already, but it's definitely, there's a lot of time there, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I really love when I speak with people on the podcast, I like to get a bit of an idea about you yourself and, how you got into dentistry and things. Do you remember what led you to dentistry and, do you even remember the day that you decided to do dentistry?
Oh, I don't know about the day, but I was brought up on a farm in central Victoria near a tiny little town. And my mother was a nurse. My father was a farmer. And so I had a combination of, that health science and very practical. Mm. And also as I was getting towards the end of school, I was doing reasonably well, so I actually spoke to our family doctor as well, and in the end I decided that dentistry offered an opportunity to combine those sort of caring interpersonal things with the practical hands-on gadgets and widgets, if you like.
Absolutely. And that's what draws us a lot to the profession is you've got healthcare, you've got patient care, you've got hands-on, and you've got gadgets and toys, which are endless. So how did you – so you studied in – I assume you studied in Melbourne, is that right?
Yeah. I had to move down to Melbourne when I was 18, and I've kind of been here ever since.
Fair enough. What was your early career like? Were your first jobs, straight after graduation?
Look, I had a couple of associate jobs, and then I actually took up a locum job at the practice, sort of where I am now, and eventually that became an associate job, and then one of the principal decided to retire, so I took over from him, and I've sort of been there ever since.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So a private practice in the suburbs of Melbourne for, I guess, a number of years now, and you're still practicing now.
Yep.
How do you split your time up at the moment?
I still practice 5 days a week, but as I do have days from time to time where I need to attend meetings and do that sort of thing. So it's a bit ad hoc, but fortunately, I can respond to those demands. Yeah.
One of the benefits of running your own show is you can have that flexibility as well.
That's right.
I'm sure that works out quite well.
Yeah.
So, of course, we're here to talk quite a lot about the item schedule, and what I want to get a really good idea of is some of the mistakes that graduates make, as well as the things that you feel perhaps some graduates aren't aware of in the schedule that can to help them with their private practice and help them go from being a student with guidance to being a private practitioner, often having to make that decision without someone to ask straight away. So what are your thoughts on the common mistakes you see with the item codes?
Well, I think where I'd start with that is that one of the best things to do is to have a look at the schedule and read it thoroughly, not just the actual items and their definitions, but the notes for guidance section at the front, because in the principles of that, it gives you a lot of idea about how to determine an item number, because at the end of the day, it's up to the treating practitioner to decide. And they're in the best position to know, because they've done the treatment, they know what they've done, to decide what the appropriate item number is. And sometimes there can be areas of confusion. One that comes up from time to time, by way of an example perhaps, is the suck down or pressure formed retainer, like the Essex retainer, as some people describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that's
a technique that's commonly in use. And it's also in use to replace a missing tooth temporarily that might end up having an implant or a bridge or something of that nature. That's the same technique, but it can be itemised a number of different ways. And one of the key principles that we talk about in the schedule is outcome-based. So the outcome determines what the item number is, even though the technique's relatively similar. So if it's replacing missing teeth, that kind of suck-down device is a denture.
Oh, yes.
If it's a retainer for orthodontic purposes, then it's a retainer. So same technique, two different outcomes, two different ways of itemising it.
Right, okay. That does make sense. So we're looking at what outcome are we giving to the patient, to the patient, and that then will describe how we can itemise it.
So that principle's designed to prevent. I mean, if we tried to itemise every tiny little variation in technique, we'd end up with thousands of item numbers. There's enough already. You could argue there's too many already.
There are enough already. Yeah.
But another example is root canal disinfection. That can be done using chemical means. It can be done with initiated disinfection. It's still the same item number because we're disinfecting the root canal at the end of the day.
Yeah. So that outcome base actually simplifies it.
Yeah. So we get a lot of pressure from time to time from people who invent a new device and they say, oh, well, you know, it does this, but does it better, so it should have a different item number. Well, first of all, it's got to be generally accepted that it does something better, and it's got to be sufficiently different in outcome rather than technique to warrant a different item number.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I'd never thought of it actually that way. I always had thought of it as, you know, what procedure are you doing, not so much what outcome. I'm going to ask, this is a specific question about that Essex retainer, because it does come up a lot. Do you know off the top of your head what it would be itemized as if it was replacing a pontic tooth?
So that becomes a denture.
Yeah, okay.
So it becomes... and it depends a bit. If you're looking at a temporary replacement and it's obviously going to be a partial replacement, then you've got a provisional partial maxillary denture.
So then your cost would probably be quite different to if it was a denture itself.
Correct, which brings us to another area of interest, and that is that item number is not equal to fee.
Yep.
So item number is a description. A fee should reflect the complexity, the materials, what you expect to make from it, all those sorts of things. And you can certainly, there's no problem with there being two different fees against one item number. I mean, we can all understand the experience of doing a very simple single surface restoration compared with some great big complex single surface restoration. Now, should they attract the same fee? Well, ultimately, that's up to the clinical judgment of the person doing the work. Do you accept a degree of cross subsidization and say, well, you know, some you're going to win some and lose some, or do you, you know, post a fee that's exactly the same, that's exactly reflects the time taken, the quality materials, et cetera, et cetera? Those are really decisions for the clinician, and provided you have adequate records to support whatever decision you've made, then that shouldn't be an issue.
And the health funds aren't going to have an issue with that either.
Well, at the end of the day, the health funds will provide whatever their scheduled rebate is. That's, you know...
it's irrelevant to the actual cost.
Correct. And in some regards, I mean, there are nowadays greater complexities because we've got people who are contracted, we've got government-funded schemes that provide a fixed rebate and a fixed fee. And, of course, if you've signed up for any of those things, you have to adhere to the conditions. But in the absence of any of those arrangements, then what we've talked about before applies.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So if you're someone who's working, with a contract with, say, a health fund, or if you're working with DVA or CDBS, then you've got a fixed fee. But if you're, you know, a private practitioner without these contracts, you can choose your fees depending on the complexity.
Correct.
And for instance, like the Essex retainer is a temporary denture, you perhaps wouldn't be charging as much as you would for an actual denture. That makes a lot of sense. That actually clears up quite a lot. You mentioned before the guidance section at the start of the item schedule. It's something I must admit, and I'm going to give away my secrets. I hadn't deeply read that until now. Tell us a bit about what's in that and why it's important.
Well, I suppose the important part about it is it provides context to using the schedule. So it has definitions. It talks about, it gives some practical examples of itemization of some sorts of devices and procedures. It also has a how the definitions of some materials fit in with the definitions are used in the schedule.
So it clarifies quite a bit of questions we might have around the schedule. That makes sense.
And then of course there's an extensive section on GST, which which is provided by tax department. And then, of course, you get into the body of the schedule. And
yeah,
the other thing to note is that if there are any specific requirements for the usage of item numbers, sometimes they'll be in the definition themselves, but if those restrictions apply across a section, they'll be right at the top under the heading.
Yeah, and they're very important things to know. We don't want to be, obviously, incorrectly itemizing because we haven't read the definition of what we're actually using.
Correct. Having said that...
Do you mind it?
Oh, go on. Yeah. Yep.
Now, go on with what you're going to say.
Well, having said that, we do get a lot of people, you know, contacting us and saying, oh, you know, the health fund says that the ADA says that, you know, that's wrong and you can't do that with that and all the rest of it. And a lot of the time we find that sort of comment to be incorrect. The committee submitted an article to the News Bulletin recently, which basically talked about that. And the schedule is reasonably transparent, and if there's any restrictions on using item numbers with other item numbers or frequencies or any of those things, they're in the book. And if it's not in the book, it really doesn't happen.
That's good to know, because I would like to ask you some quite specific questions around some item numbers, things, experiences that I've seen myself or I've seen other clinicians go through. Now, would you mind if I ask you some specifics about some questions?
Go ahead.
Some items. So one of them in particular, I had a patient come in. He'd broken his front tooth. In fact, I think he'd lost the crown. It was ill-fitting. We couldn't re-cement, but it was still restorable. We could restore it, and somehow I actually had enough time to do this for him. We use CEREC in our practice, so it was the same day crown for the patient. But I did a limited exam. I hadn't done a full checkup for him. So I charged an 013 and a 613 and perhaps a 627. And the health fund declined payment because it was an 013 with a 613. Is there any comment you can make about that? Have I made a mistake there?
No, look, it sounds to me as if your itemization is correct, but you've run up against a fund business rule. Now, the fund business rule is a business of the funds. And whilst we can make representations to the funds to indicate that the business rule doesn't make sense, ultimately they're private businesses and they're responsible. They have a ultimate authority about how they operate the their business rules. Now, we probably have a lot of concerns that those business rules are not very transparent, and that, you know, because ultimately it's not your problem, it's the patient's problem. But the patient's paid up their subscription, and yet they have a little transparency as to what's going to be covered and in what circumstances.
So how do we find out those business rules and differences?
It's not easy. And we have numerous different policies, companies, et cetera, in the field, and there's no consistency between them either. So they can vary within a fund depending on the level of cover that patients have. Mm. They can vary between funds. It's a very difficult area, and one that we are constantly talking to funds about.
How do we find out more about these business rules so that we don't have this issue for the patient?
Well, I suppose I find it a very frustrating area because of that, what I mentioned before, that they vary quite a lot between funds, and so and it's difficult to get them to share. We've wanted to get them to share some of those with us, but they consider them to be, you know, commercially important to them, and they're not necessarily wanting to share them.
I find that actually quite fascinating because I don't know how we're meant to itemize correctly within their business rules if we don't know their business rules.
I agree with you.
That's interesting. Do you see that changing in the future?
The ADA is certainly advocating for much more transparency in this area from both for both the convenience of the practitioners and for the benefit of the patients. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the patients who are paying the premium, and they're not. It's not clear to them often until they attend for treatment and are faced with a cost. It's not clear to them what sort of rebate's going to be available to them.
It
happens across a number of dimensions too. For instance, you see the funds talking about major dental and minor dental.
Mm.
Now they're not characterizations that the ADA would use to describe treatment. But funds will have divisions within what they pay rebates for, calling some things major dental, some things minor dental, or using other terms. And they aren't consistent either.
Hmm. It's a very difficult area to navigate, obviously, for the patient and for us as clinicians. It's really sad, actually, because the person who truly does lose out is the patient. The situation I was talking about, having itemized it that way, being completely unaware of this kind of thing, the patient was declined the rebate on the 613. Obviously, that's a significant amount of money. In the end, it worked out for the patient in a way because they had other treatment to be done, and they ended up maxing out their fund anyway. So it wouldn't have made a difference in the long run. But I just couldn't believe it, I felt terrible as well.
It's an awkward situation for practitioners. And in that case, it might have worked out all right. But in other cases, that might be the only problem that the patient had.
Exactly.
The ADA website does have available for members some resources to give feedback to the ADA about circumstances like this. And the ADA will take them on board if they have adequate information, et cetera, and pursue particularly when we see a sort of a pattern of content of those sorts of things, we'll try and influence to what extent we can those behaviours of funds.
That's really good to know, and definitely an avenue that's worth utilising if you experience that kind of situation.
But, of course, we need the information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. We've got to reach out to our ADA who's supporting us to help for sure. Do you foresee, or does the ADA have a bit of a list of these things, or is it really quite unknown?
Oh, look, the schedule committee has a database of some of these things because they're the ones that we see coming to us. Coming to us in the process of our communications, etc., but not a comprehensive one. No.
Is there any reason that we can't form something like that? And what I mean by that is perhaps someone like myself or the ADA themselves having a publication of ones, as the health funds won't tell us directly, but we can find out by having trial and error.
I think there's probably some difficulties in terms of the ADA publishing those sorts of things that aren't comprehensive. I've been doing this for quite a long time, and I still find these funny little anomalies that crop up from time to time. And to give the health funds some, some of these issues are not overall health fund policy. They're sometimes result from misunderstandings at health fund desks and these sorts of things as well.
Sometimes it's actually error.
Errors just happen sometimes.
Yes, of course. And you've got to assume the health funds are not purposely trying to rip off their clients. I guess in that kind of situation, so that was an 013 and a 613. It's a pretty rare thing to happen, obviously. It's certainly the first time for me. But there are a few others. I once had a health fund decline payment of a temporary restoration of 572 at the same time as an extirpation of 419.
Yeah.
Is that something you see often, and is that is there any issue with actually claiming those two things?
Well, I think the issue is that, well, we do see that a bit. It is a legitimate thing to do, provided you're actually, I mean, the purpose of the 571 that you do at that time has to be to make the tooth amenable to having root canal treatment. So it's
exactly it's something that must be done before you start, regardless.
So, in other words, if you've got a perfectly sound restoration, maybe that you did, you know, a couple of weeks ago or something, and you cut a hole through it because the tooth's become non-vital, and you want to claim that as a 571, that's not appropriate. But if you've got
and that makes sense.
If you've got a broken down tooth with caries or fracture to the margin, close to the gingival margin or whatever, and in order to put the rubber dam on and be sure that you've got the root canal sealed, you have to do a degree of temporization, then it's perfectly legitimate to use both.
And to clarify, it's not legitimate if you're doing, say, a 415, because by that time you should have
all. Well, yeah. Look. If you know, in a circumstance where you have time, and rather than doing an extirpation and getting the patient to come back at a later time, if you've got time and a patient comes in, they've got a broken down tooth, it's non-vital, it needs root canal treatment, it's still legitimate to use the 571 if you need to temporise it in order to gain appropriate sealing and structure to put your rubber dam on.
Yeah, in the same situation, a 419 might have been used. That makes sense as well. Another specific question that I think some graduates would like to know about is a very similar situation, actually. I've seen, and I don't agree with it, but you'll clarify, charging a 419 and a 415 at the same time. That's not correct. Is that right?
I would agree with you there. So the procedures involved in a 415 involved in a 419 plus more. So effectively, if you do the 415, you're doing a 419 plus a bit more.
Yes, that's how I thought about it as well. And I think that's a really important point. Obviously, sometimes a misunderstanding of the item codes could end up with overcharging a patient. And I think that's something we should all know about. Are there any other examples you can think of where people do make these mistakes inadvertently and shouldn't be charging two items together?
One that comes up a bit is the use of 071.
Oh, yes.
And so, for instance, you might find someone making a mouth guard who would itemise the mouth guard, but add an 071. And in those circumstances, that's not appropriate because the 071 should only be used for models which are going to be retained as part of the record. If the models are made simply to facilitate construction of appliance, whether it be a mouth guard, splint, crown, whatever it might be, they're working models and they're implicitly part of the outcome of making the mouth guard.
So that makes sense. You can't make the mouth guard without it, so it's obviously included. If we're charging for a diagnostic wax-up, would we still be charging for the models as well, as they're part of the record?
I would have thought so, provided, you know, it's really the clinician's judgment, and if you charge for an 071, then it's going to be incumbent on you to have that record, that model or record of the model, I suppose, in your records for future reference.
Yes, okay. And that's a good point as well. So with records and models, we actually need to keep them for quite a long time. How long is that?
Well, it's generally accepted about 7 years. It gets a bit more complicated when the patient's a minor.
Yes.
Because you then are looking at waiting until they achieve majority and then retain them for that same period.
Yes, okay, 7 years from the date they turn. Is it turning 18 or turning 16?
I think it's 18.
There's another specific situation I'd like to ask you about, and it's one that I've always been a little confused with. If we have a patient who, say they have a tooth, say a lower central that is hopeless periodontal prognosis, and we've deemed the best option to be to remove the tooth, to cut the root off and then to splint it to the adjacent teeth, a ribbon splint done directly. I've always been confused how to itemize that. Is it something you could clear up for me, how it would be adequately itemized?
Sorry, if we can just go over that again. You're removing a tooth and then you're bonding a new pontic in place.
Yeah, so and there's two ways you can do it. One is using the tooth itself, but removing the root and using it as the pontic.
Correct.
Or building it up with composite.
Yeah, so either technique is itemized as a direct pontic.
So either whether you build it up or not, it's still a direct pontic.
Because once again, we go back to the outcome principle.
Yeah.
So we end up with a direct pontic. We could make it out of composite. We could use an acrylic tooth. We could use the patient's own tooth. And then we will have some sort of attachment to the adjacent tooth. And that could be, itemized as a single surface restoration or a multi-surface restoration. Sometimes you might utilize an existing restoration in the adjacent tooth. That, once again, is dependent on the clinical situation.
Would you ever use a splinting and stabilization in that situation?
Oh, you might do that if you have additional, let's say it's a lower central incisor that one removes because of periodontal disease, and you have adjacent mobile teeth that you think are appropriate for splinting to assist them not to be lost, that might be appropriate.
Okay. And as you said, we're coming back to that outcome. Like, what is the outcome we're giving our patient? And that's how we think about our itemization.
Correct.
That makes sense. A couple of other questions, and this is one I've always been a little confused with. With just simple consultation codes, and I know we're getting right back to basics now, there's a couple codes. We've got 011 comprehensive, 012 recall exam, 013 is a limited exam, and then 014 a extended, I believe it's extended.
Well, there's 014 is consultation and 015 is extended. Yeah.
Thank you. How do we define 014, 015? So extended, what's the definition of that, or is it just up to the clinician?
Well, I think the extended defines itself as more than 30 minutes. Okay. So it's really similar to a consultation, except that it obviously takes longer. And that's just a recognition that in some cases, perhaps particularly complex cases, in order for the patient to have a full understanding and be able to give appropriate, perhaps both financial and other treatment consent, it may take considerable time to go through all those things.
Certainly. So that's a good point, actually, and something I think I made the mistake of earlier on was when a patient came back for a consultation regarding more complex treatment and they wanted to know a bit more about their options. In the past, if I'd looked in the mouth, I might have charged an 013, but it should have been an 014 or perhaps an 015 depending on the time.
That's perhaps the case. I mean, it just depends on the circumstances, really. You might sort of suggest that you may need more of an 011 or an 012 before you do a consultation so that you exactly know.
Yes, and that's what my thoughts are if I'd already done that.
All the circumstances about the patient's condition.
Yes, and that makes sense. So understanding their condition or going through the 012 or 011 and then if you bring them back or if they want to come back and discuss further, we'd go and use those other codes.
And, of course, there might be other item numbers associated with those procedures because you may have tests, x-rays, you might take study models. It just depends on the clinical circumstances at the time.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Thanks for clearing some of those questions up. Are there any other things you can think of off the top of your mind that clinicians perhaps are often confused with, or questions that often come into the schedule committee that you'd like to share?
Oh, look, I think one of the things I'd probably just, you know, like to emphasise, and I have is kind of the importance of good records, which is a bit peripheral to what we're saying, but having good records in the, you know, as it's obviously increasingly occurring nowadays, is audits that result from the analysis of claiming patent by funds. And of course, if you've got, even if your pattern of itemisation perhaps is in their opinion aberrant, if you're legitimately doing things correctly and you have appropriate records to support what you've been doing, then you should be able to defend that.
It always comes back to, yeah, if you've recorded it, it's happened and you can defend, and if you haven't wrote it down, it didn't happen.
That's more or less the situation, yes.
Yeah, really good advice. Let's take a little zoom out a little bit. I know we've been talking some depth about the item codes, and I don't want to put everyone to sleep, but I think it's really important that graduates and students and dentists in general do know these things and know them well. But I want to zoom out and just ask you a question about third parties. And what I'm thinking about is, of course, health funds. We see health funds in different countries, particularly the United States, or the insurance companies, having quite a big impact on decision making and on the treatment that they essentially allow to occur. A lot of American dentists express feeling controlled by the health funds or by the insurance companies. What do you foresee the future relationship being between health funds and dentists in Australia? Do you see it going more towards that United States style of system?
Well, I think that the funds are keen to pursue more and more control. But on the other hand, we see recent data that a lot of patients are sort of starting to really question the value of their fund membership.
And rightly so.
And so I suppose, look, you know, the ADA has a number of policies around how we think health funds should operate, and of course a key one in this day and age of preferred provider contracts and also, you know, funds running their own clinics, etc., is that if you patients should be entitled to the same rebate no matter which dentist they choose to visit, and if you pay the same premium, you should get the same outcome.
Do you think that's do you see that changing or improving for patients, or do you think there's a lot more to go in changing that?
Well, I think there's a lot of work to go. It's not an area that I'm particularly involved in, so I can't talk at length about the lobbying that's going on by the federal body in detail. But it's certainly something that's being very strongly pursued in order.
That's good to know. Yeah,
and you know, if you want to look at it in a bit more detail, you can have a look at the policies and that are available on the website, which will give a lot more meat, if you like, to the views that the ADA has about these matters.
It's definitely something that's on the mind of a lot of younger dentists and a lot of people in the dental community. So it's good to know that there is some advocacy going on. So I want to ask you a few final questions. I really like asking these questions for most of my guests. So we're taking a bit of a step away from the ADA and the item schedule, etc.
Yep.
But as yourself, as a dentist, tell us a little bit about what you would like to have told yourself if you could go back to when you graduated. So something that you think might have changed your career, improved your career, or helped you just as you graduated from university.
It's a very good question, really. I think that one of the things that probably I've learned over time is that at the end of the day, my role is to be able to provide certain technical services and education to patients. Now, some patients will be very keen to take those on and some not so much. And at the end of the day, I suppose I was, you know, when you're first starting out, you want to have positive interactions with everyone and fix everyone up and, you know, give them a better life. And I still want to do that. But I think that you have to have a dose of a bit of realism that in some cases you're not going to please everyone, if you like, and you shouldn't beat yourself up too much about it.
I think that's a really important message that in the end, no matter how good we are, we're not going to please every patient. We have different personalities and some patients need a different kind of dentist to you or I, and that's fine. That's so important. It's such an important message.
And the patient's problems are the patient's problems.
Yeah, yeah.
We can offer all sorts of technology and advice and techniques and all of those things, but at the end of the day, the patient needs to take them on.
Exactly. And we, I think, also need to, as much as, you know, help our patients and, you know, do our very best, but in the end recognize that these problems, we're helping for someone else and their problem. It's not our problem. Yeah. And, you know, not letting that get us down as well. It's a really important message.
And we've got to look after ourselves because, you know, you can't provide the best of care to patients if you're not looking after your own health, both mental health and physical health. And that comes into, you know, relaxing, having outside interests, being aware of your fitness and posture and all of these sorts of things, which fortunately I think there's a lot more information about nowadays than there was when I started out.
Yeah. Yeah, David, very, very wise words and definitely many topics that are really important to me and Dental Head Start and what I'm trying to do with this podcast. So thank you for sharing your views on that as well as the ADA item schedule, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
There we have it. Thank you, David Kernow, for spending the time with us. David wants to make one minor adjustment to what he said. You probably picked up on it. He mentioned 571. He meant 572 as a temporary filling. When you get into this situation with item codes and issues, don't forget to reach out to the ADA. They are there to help us, especially if you're a member, but they also help those who are not. So thank you for the support from BOQ Specialist Bank as well as Dental Protection Limited. We've also got another partnership coming up, which I'm really excited to announce. It's something that's going to help you guys as well as support the podcast. And finally, I want you guys to help me out. I want you to share this with a friend. I want you to send this to someone or to put it in your story. Let someone know who you think will actually benefit from this, because I really hope that as many people who will benefit will hear this. So thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to the next episode.